force, and they took over these corridors. And that presence of what I call the blood, the sweat, the tears of the people at the front lines of the climate crisis is what we need inside this room. And unfortunately, although we have to say it is much better in Brazil than when we had the COP in Egypt, in United Arab Emirates, and Azerbaijan, which we didn't even were able to do the protest in the street, the march of climate. But that's actually, I think, the forces in the 21st century. The people at the front lines against the fossil fuel capital.
We only have a minute to go, but I wanted to ask you two quick questions. The significance of President Trump, for the first time, the United States not sending a high-level delegation. Do you actually think that's good or bad in terms of how they influence the outcome? And also, you are a Colombian of Palestinian descent, and your thoughts right now on what's happening in Gaza?
Yes, on the first one, it's absolutely terrible the United States is not here. It's the second biggest polluter in the world. And we, to be able, I mean, this is the problem. This problem cannot be solved by any single country. It has to be the global community together. But the worst thing is the escalation of the conflict. Before, it used to be blocking here, as some countries are doing. But now it's with military action. So having the U.S. military, deployment of military forces to the Caribbean, had killed 80 Latin Americans in total impunity in the last 2 months, with nobody stopping that. And actually, my fear is that what the President Trump is coming for is for the oil resources of Venezuela and also the minerals of Colombia and Latin and South America. If this is going to be the escalation of conflict, we actually in a very bad shape. That's why it will be a fantastic message from Brazil that more than 80 countries, on the majority of countries, said no. We are not going to change the agenda because there is military bullying from any powerful country right now. And we have to secure the humanity. And on Gaza, these are not issues that are not correlated. Because they use Gaza as a laboratory, because they were able to move forward, and even President Trump declared in the Israeli parliament that the weapons were given by the U.S. to commit genocide, because this has happened, and the world, the United Nations, nobody could stop this. That's why they have now the license, the green light to start moving forward to pursue whatever interests they think they want to pursue. And this is why we have to strengthen the international community and multilateralism, and also the resistance in the front lines of these issues, because I tell you something, people will not allow any military power to kill them. Even the Palestinians right now, with everything that has happened, are still resisting. And that's actually a lesson from all of us. Because if the defense of the environment will become a military conflict, we are already seeing in Palestine what could happen in the future. I don't wish that future. I think we can actually, humanity can do better, and that we can be very proactive and productive in shifting this situation of climate crisis, rather than continue investing in arms, in armies, and in defense, as the whole world is doing. So there's no money for climate, but then everybody in 2 seconds puts 5% of their GDP in defense.
Well, Susana Muhammad, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Longtime environmentalist, served as Colombia's Minister of Environment and Sustainable Development from 2022 to earlier this year. Also president of the 2024 UN Biodiversity Conference held in Cali, Colombia. She is of Palestinian descent. When we come back, we'll speak with Sudanese climate researcher Lina Yassin, who is here at COP30 supporting the least developed countries, the LDC group. And we'll speak with Jean Su, co-author of the new report, Data Crunch, How the AI Boom Threatens to Entrench Fossil Fuels and Compromise Climate Goals. We're at COP30 in Belém, Brazil, gateway to the Amazon. Stay with us.
Ah, tamo aberta a tua maravilha.
from the UN Climate Summit, COP 30, from the Brazilian city of Belém, the gateway to the Amazon. I'm Amy Goodman. We're joined right now by Lina Yassin, who supports the LDC group. That's the least developed countries at the UN Climate Summit. She's a climate diplomacy researcher at the International Institute for Environment and Development, or IIED, in London. She's from Sudan, previously supported the Sudanese delegation at the COP. We're going to talk to you about the crisis in Sudan in a moment. But first, talk about why you're here. And as not using technical terms, or if you do, tell people what exactly you mean, whether you use words like adaptation or loss and damage. I think to the outside world, they think we can't just deal. We can't understand what they're talking about. But talk about the progress and the lack of progress at this COP.
Thank you for having me, Amy. So I'm here because, like you mentioned, the least developed countries is a group of 44 countries. Those countries contributed the very least to the climate crisis. Their cumulative emissions amount to less than 1%, yet those countries amounting to over 1 billion persons are suffering the worst of the climate crisis. They are the countries that have the least amount of resources to respond to the climate crisis, including my country, Sudan. So I'm here because we are supporting these countries in the negotiations to come up with outcomes that don't just sound great, but actually work on the ground. My focus is on adaptation. And adaptation negotiations are incredibly important because adaptation is as simple as farmers knowing how to deal with the unpredictable rainfall and the crop failure. It's as simple as communities needing to rebuild after a flood or after a cyclone. It's as simple as hospitals being able to function when the storm has cut off the electricity, when they have to deal with a cholera outbreak, malaria outbreak. Adaptation is incredibly practical. It is water, it is housing, it is basic human safety.
And how can other countries help with that? What does Sudan need, for example?
The LDCs in Sudan need finance. Unfortunately, adaptation cannot work if there's no money on the ground to actually finance it. And adaptation is fundamentally a public good. Building infrastructure, investing in infrastructure so that countries can survive floods, cyclones, hurricanes, has to come from public finance. And right now, unfortunately, the finance conversation is the most uncomfortable conversation to have in this space. The UNEP GAP report, the 2025 GAP report, has said that in order to actually finance adaptation properly, we need $310 billion per year for developing countries. Right now, developing countries are getting $26 billion.
So you might have people in the United States saying, okay, Sudan's suffering, as are other least developed countries. It's not our fault. We need money in the United States. Why should we give money to other countries? Can you talk about the responsibility of the most polluting countries?
Yes, and we can go back all the way to the Industrial Revolution, where many developed countries and wealthy countries have benefited from the exploitation of coal and fossil fuels and have built and established themselves as wealthy countries, whilst other countries did not have that chance. So now we find ourselves in a predicament because we need to stop emitting carbon emissions, and we need to stop responding to the crisis. But countries like my country need to develop. So there is an element of justice and fairness where we need to be able to support those countries because right now their development is far behind the rest of the world, and they need to be included in this conversation. So and the reason, another reason is climate change doesn't know border. What's happening in my country, what's happening in other countries, will eventually get to other countries. It's a collective responsibility, and we need to remember that climate change touches us all.
So let me ask you about the funding cuts from USAID and how that impacts these discussions, as well as funding cuts from the UK and the European Union.
It's really unfortunate that we find ourselves at the time when the climate crisis is increasing, when the evidence are even more scary. We find ourselves in a situation where governments are scaling back on their budgets, on their aid budgets. The U.S. is also leaving the Paris Agreement. This is going to be the last year where the U.S. is officially part of the Paris Agreement. So this is... it has a big negative impact because this whole system, this negotiation is built on trust. Multilateralism can only work if everyone does their fair share, and we're finding ourselves in a time where budgets are being rerouted to military spendings, even though when we talk about security and investing in national security, we should be talking about climate change. That's the biggest security threat that every country is facing right now.
What is the Just Transition Work Program?
So the just transition is another incredibly important conversation, because right now we've established that we need to stop oil demand. Oil needs to peak. Fossil fuels need to transition away from fossil fuels. But how do we do that while ensuring no one is left behind? So the least developed countries and other developing countries are saying our development will be impacted. How do we make sure we transition to low carbon economies, green economies, while ensuring our people get jobs, our people get rights, and can still develop while we solve the climate crisis?
And talk overall about the energy transition.
Yeah, so the energy transition is another uncomfortable conversation, unfortunately, in this space. When we come here to talk about climate change, you would expect us to be talking mostly about fossil fuels, and because the fossil fuel is the main driver of carbon emissions. But fossil fuels are rarely mentioned in the spaces. It's the word that no one wants to say. It's the elephant in the room.
But of course, it's the word on the tips of the tongues of what the 1,600 lobbyists who are here.
Yes, and that's another conversation to be had. This space is highly influenced. This space has a lot of many, many lobbyists who are highly influencing countries and governments to weaken the outcomes, to slow down this process. So we need to be talking about this, but we also need to be more explicit about the fact that climate change is not waiting for us, and we can't be using a multilateral space, the only space that our countries have to have strong outcomes. And we're being told you need to take it step by step, incremental, slow steps.
So I want to shift our discussion right now to what's actually happening in Sudan. The UN's humanitarian chief, Tom Fletcher, is urging immediate and unhindered access for aid agencies to the besieged city of El Fasher, which was recently captured by the UAE-backed RSF, that's the Rapid Support Forces. Tens of thousands of city residents remain unaccounted for. Last month, we spoke to Nathaniel Raymond of the Yale Humanitarian Research Lab, which has been using satellite imagery to monitor what's happened in El Fasher. Let's take a listen.
We see clear evidence of house-to-house killing, as evidenced by the appearance in the street and by the berm, the earthen wall surrounding El Fasher, of objects that range from 1.3 meters to 2 meters in satellite imagery. Why that's important is the average human body, when laid on the ground horizontally, measures between 1.3 to 2 meters. Additionally, we're seeing around those objects in many cases a peculiar red discoloration in the initial imagery collection. We believe that red discoloration can only be explained by blood, given our processing of those discolorations. They are all the same color, which is called red.
That was Nathaniel Raymond of the Yale Humanitarian Research Lab. Lina Yassin, you are from Sudan. You had to leave. Many in your family have not left. He is talking about how rare this is from satellites to see blood on the ground.
What we're seeing right now is an international failure to address the biggest humanitarian crisis of our time. It's been 949 days. I count those days every morning because it's something that I cannot forget. We, as Sudanese people, have been forgotten by the world. It's the biggest humanitarian crisis, but also one of the most underreported. What's happening right now in El Fasher is a disappointment by the international community. We're not addressing this enough. And unfortunately, this is a war that is being classified by the media as a civil war. This is not a civil war. This is a war on Sudanese people. This is a proxy war funded by foreign nationals who have vested interest in Sudan's resources. And instead of doing so through mutual beneficial collaborations, they choose to do so by funding a militia that is killing people, committing genocide.
Let's talk more specifically about what I think you're referring to. The United Arab Emirates supporting the RSF, the Rapid Support Forces. Explain, what is the UAE's interest in Sudan?
The UAE has a lot of interest in Sudan, and that is driven by its sources. Sudan and its big has a big deposit of gold, and the UAE has been using the RSF militia to illegally smuggle gold out to finance the war and finance their own gold reserves. The UAE is also really interested in Sudan's agricultural lands. The UAE imports 90% of its food. So its long-term food security is reliant on investing in agriculture outside, but instead of doing so through cooperation, what they want to do is they want to invest in a militia that can take over the country and be able to finance their needs long-term. This is a long-term vision of taking over Sudan, and unfortunately, they chose to do so through the bloodshed of Sudanese people.
So you participated in the protests when you were there in 2019. This is a seminal moment in Sudan. Also, protests that were led by women. After the months of protests, President al-Bashir, who'd been in power for like 30 years, was overthrown. And there was tremendous hope in the country. Talk about that experience and what you would like to see now and what other countries are benefiting from the horror that has taken place in Sudan right now.
The revolution in 2019 was a turning point for many of us. I grew up in a dictatorship system where I never knew that my voice could be heard. I was always scared of being arrested just for wearing a jeans or not wearing a scarf. Growing up in a dictatorship system, I thought my life cannot be spent in Sudan. My future needs to be outside. But the 2019 revolution, which was largely led by youth and women, was a turning point for all of us. We realized that we could actually take back our country. We could rebuild our country, and we could do it in a democratic way. I never voted in my life. I was looking forward to doing that as an experience, and that was taken away from us because even though we led one of the biggest and most successful revolutions in the history of our country, it was taken away from us just years later by a military coup because the military also wants to be in power and just cannot let go. So this is, to us, is really unfortunate because what started off as hopefully what would have been a new history for Sudan ended up in this war that we find ourselves unable to leave.
And what do you hear of your family right now still in Sudan? And do you think you can go back?
I've not been back home in over 2.5 years. I don't know when is the next time I'm going to see home. I have family in Sudan that we are unable to talk to because there's no way to contact them. There's no electricity. But the reason I'm here is because all of this is happening. And as much as I feel a big disconnect, I also know that climate change doesn't wait for peace. Whilst everything is going on in Sudan, floods are still washing away refugee camps. Farmers who don't get killed by bullets are getting killed by hunger because their crops are failing.
What would be the most effective approach that the international community can take right now?
The most effective approach is to start recognizing and calling this war what it is. It's not a civil war. Let's start by shifting the narrative, and let's start by applying pressure. The U.S. and other countries can apply pressure on those funding the war to stop doing so and try and achieve peace. It's really unfortunate that Sudan is not being talked about enough, and the international community is to blame for this.
I want to thank you so much, Lena, for taking your time as you are here working with the least developed countries in the COP30. Lena Yassin is a Sudanese climate researcher who is at the climate summit here in Belém, Brazil. Up next, data crunch, how the AI boom threatens to entrench fossil fuels and compromise climate goals. Back in a minute.
So.
Malian blind couple, Mariam is still alive, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio years ago. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit, COP 30, from the Brazilian city of Belém, the gateway to the Amazon. Among the most controversial topics here is artificial intelligence, AI. Climate groups are warning of the increasing environmental impacts of AI data centers. Meanwhile, AI advocates say artificial intelligence could help the world address the climate crisis. For more, we're joined by Jean Hsu, Energy Justice Director at the Center for Biological Diversity, the co-author of a report the center published ahead of COP30 titled Data Crunch, How the AI Boom Threatens to Entrench Fossil Fuels and Compromise Climate Goals. Jean, welcome to Democracy Now! Explain.
AI right now is being touted as some type of solution to the climate emergency. Even here at the COP, there have been over two dozen panels talking about how wonderful it is and how it will help with balancing the electricity grid, which is totally valid. But what is one concern, deep concern about AI is its severe climate consequences. And no one in the official negotiations are talking about that right now.
So you come from the United States.
Yes.
The U.S. is the biggest emitter of carbon emissions from AI, making up 45% of the world's emissions. Some people might be saying right now, what does AI have to do with carbon emissions?
Oh, wow. So AI is an incredible computing power. It is going to consume, and it has consumed, far more electricity than current Google searches or current algorithms. What's happening in the U.S. in particular is that we are ground zero for data center development. Around 90% of all computing goes through the United States. The scary thing about AI is that it is being primarily powered by fracked gas and increasingly coal right now in the U.S. The Trump administration has issued a ton of executive orders asking permitting reform and allowing kind of rubber stamping of data centers to get them connected to as much dirty energy as possible to fuel it.
So I was just talking to Casey Camp Hornick. She is a representative of the Ponca Nation in Oklahoma, and they've been fighting a Google data center in Stillwater,
yes.
Oklahoma. Talking to folks in Memphis, Tennessee, taking on data centers. Explain,
yes.
though, how it works. I mean, some need what? They're talking about smart nukes, a nuclear power plant to fuel just a data center?
Yes. So there are nuclear power plants that are being erected for data centers. New fossil gas plants are being built out for data centers. And these are such energy-guzzling entities that it can actually take up as much electricity as 100,000 homes in the United States. So this is a whole new set of electricity need in the U.S. that we need to address immediately. The really scary part about what's happening in the U.S. is that communities are just being so surprised, and they're being completely caught flat-footed about data centers. They're using everything they have to convince their town leaders to say no, no to the incredible energy costs, but also no to the incredible water as well.
Can renewables be used to power data centers?
Renewables can be used to power data centers, and that is one thing we are advocating for, even in the UNFCCC process. But I think what's really important is that that is not what is happening in the ground. Utilities make money off of building out more expensive energy. So that means they are inclined to build out fossil gas plants because that is what helps their bottom line.
A recent study by the UNFCCC mechanism found AI can also be a powerful tool for developing countries that are most vulnerable to the climate crisis through developing more effective early warning systems, which is so important. Of course, people will say, Jean, what are you talking about? Medicine has advanced so far with AI. So what do you see? What is your vision of the future? Do you see it including AI, and how?
I think the future can include the AI that actually benefits the public interest. However, that is a foil and a red herring for the vast majority of AI right now, which is actually being used on defense and militarization, things that do not necessarily benefit the public interest. What we need to do is empower communities and countries, especially in the global south, to ask what is the public benefit that they are supposed to get from AI, and weigh it very carefully against the severe costs to their climate, to their electricity prices, into their water.
Does the COP30 text address AI?
Not yet. And our goal here is to actually make that happen. So this year, we have connected with global civil society organizations around the world to actually come together and from the ground up, build a map of what AI and the fossil fuel industry is seeing from the top down in terms of their strategy. We are working on coordinated efforts on the ground and to come back to COP next year with a clear ask of countries must discuss and disclose their data center emissions and commit to building them with renewable energy that is sustainable and not with false solutions like CCS.
A question I've been putting to a lot of our guests is the significance of President Trump deciding this is for the first time a U.S. delegation, high-level delegation, would not attend COP. What is the significance of it and him calling climate change a hoax, a green hoax, a scam?
Yeah, the significance of it is that President Trump is in the world to peddle his wares. He is peddling natural gas, fracked gas, his coal. That is his vision of his future, and it's entirely about profiteering. What's so important about this COP is that people should celebrate the fact that that obstruction is not here and pass as fast as possible mechanisms like a fossil fuel phase-out roadmap where the U.S. is not here, but they could be bound by it later when they join. And that's the importance of this COP. We actually need a game plan to phase out fossil fuels in a funded manner. And if we can pass that here, the U.S., as the number one historic emitter and as one of the wealthiest countries in the world, will have to abide by it when it comes back.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. Jean Hsu is the Energy Justice Director at the Center for Biological Diversity. Will link to their new report, Data Crunch, how the AI boom threatens to entrench fossil fuels and compromise climate goals. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes. I want to thank Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Dennis Moynihan, Sam Alkoff, Tarina Nadura, who are a Belim team on the ground, and also Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood, Safwat Nizal. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Thank you also to Becca Staley and to our whole team on the ground in New York, John Randolph and Paul Powell and Miguel Nogueira. I'm Amy Goodman from Belém, Brazil.
Hey, SFU! Getting money back for all your empty or refundable bottles and cans just got a lot easier. Just sign up for Returned Express for free. You can bag your containers, tag the bag, and drop it through the window at the new Express and Go container in the East parking lot. Return It will count your containers and credit your refunds to your online account. Learn more at returnit.ca/SFU.
CJSF 90.1 FM would like to remind listeners that the following program is a repeat broadcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, how do?
You're tuned to the Blurred Crusade. No!